You're listening to CKUT. The following programming is taken from CKUT's Time Capsule Archives. For more from our 35 years of freeform broadcasting, visit our website at ckut.ca.
Still we echoes. Good evening. This is Audio Smut on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's currently 6 p.m. and you've just listened to The Donor by the incredible Judy Sill. In the studio today, we are live with Michael Martini. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, and my name is Mycelium. We have you in the studio today to talk about your upcoming show, Landscape Grinder, which premieres on April 11th and runs through April 15th at La Chapelle. This is really exciting. I think it's you've been going around making theater for a very, very long time, but this is probably
not
your
that long.
This is probably your biggest production yet. Yes. So it's super exciting. And everyone should go on La Chapelle's website right now and get their tickets. Do you want to introduce yourself a little bit and talk about your practice?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. My name is indeed Michael Martini, like you said. I have been doing theater, not for very, very, very long, but for long enough. I completed Concordia's playwriting program, which actually no longer exists. I was one of the last people to leave it.
Rest in peace.
Yeah, rest in power. And I graduated in 2018, I think, and have since been... Yeah, pretty active, making theater, often collaborating with dancers, visual artists, making all the stuff that falls in between different categories, interdisciplinary, bilingual stuff. And often make theater projects on more of an DIY underground kind of scale. And it's pretty exciting to be doing this show. It's a full length show that I wrote that I'm performing in. And it's big. It's quite ambitious. So it's very exciting to put this out there.
Yeah, it's true. You're wearing many hats. You're simultaneously the writer of the show, the director of the show, and one of the performers. Mm-hmm. How does this feel, juggling all these roles at the same time?
It's very tricky to jump in and out of something, to see it from the outside while feeling it from the inside. And it's also, I think, incredibly... it feels incredibly revealing in a way. That's one way you can put it, I guess. But to show yourself not just as someone on stage moving and speaking, but also revealing your own ideas and your own feelings through text and through the way that you direct them and coordinate them spatially, it can be quite intimidating, but it's also quite beautiful and quite special when it goes as you hope.
Mm-hmm. I for one, am very excited to see it come together. And it's got a beautiful crew of performers as well. Do you want to talk about them a little bit? And
yeah, I'd be happy to. It's a group of people from really different disciplines. From theater, we have Gabe Maharjan and Shadia Kakonjo. We also have, from kind of the dance world, Justin DeLuna and dance visual arts, Emma-Kate Guimont. And, of course, also the wonderful Lenore Claire Harum is in the show, who's coming kind of from cabaret, video art, experimental art. And it's a really nice group. It's a very queer group also. Mm-hmm. A group of mostly queer and non-binary and trans artists working together, which has been very special also. And most of us have been working together for quite a while, with just a couple changes here and there, but it's fun to have a large group. It's very rare these days. Mm. Often you do a solo show or a duo, so it's very fun. It feels kind of like a community theater production or something to be working together.
Yeah, you've described your work as very social, and it's definitely, it can be felt in this production. And this this kind of queer approach and team also brings me to the thematics maybe of the show. I was wondering if you would like to, I don't know, you don't have to spill the beans and tell all the punches, but you can still maybe give us like a brief idea of what the show touches on. Yeah. and is concerned with.
Yeah, well, I don't think I'll be spoiling any jokes or anything by telling you that the show is about kind of parallels between the Me Too movement, the environmental justice movement, and also a quite personal narrative of sexual questioning, gender questioning, and kind of trying to connect the dots between that experience of kind of searching for oneself with the backdrop of the Me Too movement and the environmental justice movement. Like, it was a piece that I wrote around 2018, maybe started writing like in kind of sketch form in 2017, sketching out rather, not like improv sketches, sketching out in 2017. So it's obviously quite a different climate. And that period, I think, is still very present in the piece, and it's very interesting and challenging to materialize this text with that distance to the time period that it came, which is only a couple of years, but like what enormous amounts of change and in the feelings and in these movements that we've seen in those past couple of years. So
yeah, absolutely. Both those movements have, like, simultaneously, not much has changed systematically. Mm-hmm. On like a larger scale. Like, we haven't seen that much change.
No.
But in the way that they are understood and discussed, things have changed extremely since, because you started working on the show in 2018. So that was is that correct?
Yeah, I would have started writing about in 2017 and it probably started getting off its feet in 2018. Of course, theater moves very slowly. It's not like you work on something for, 4 years straight. It's like you work on it maybe for a couple months in that year, a couple months the next year. But indeed, I mean, at that time, just taking, the Me Too movement apart from the others that we were talking about, like, there's a huge amount of change. Like, it was for a while at such a fever pitch that it was something that everyone was feeling and responding to in their day-to-day life, whether they were talking about, what they heard on the radio or saw on the news, or whether they were talking about what was going on in their own personal lives or the work or their workplaces or their schools or whatever, their friendships. It was extremely present to be using the vocabulary of that movement. And there's certainly, you know, some people even mentioned that movement kind of pejoratively, like in a kind of passé way. Mm. Like, that's very Me Too, that's very this, that's very that, that's very 2017. So it's strange to breathe life into a text that was written then during kind of this fever pitch to incorporate that distance rather than ignore it, to comment on it. But it also is it's very strange as a writer and as a performer to no longer be caught up in that really collective feeling of how ubiquitous those feelings were then. Yeah.
Mm. And it's kind of symptomatic also of, I think, if I'm not mistaken, kind of the initial, like, hashtag Me Too was started by a black woman called Tamara Burke, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing right now, for example, with the terminology woke, you know, which originated from black social movements as a way to be mindful of white supremacy. This terminology has been completely stripped of its original meaning, and it's just kind of like become a kind of weird dog whistle to talk about any and all left-leaning type of politics. And mm-hmm. Me Too, again, has been digested in the accumulation of discourse, of course, primarily online, even though these conversations happen also in real life, of course. Mm-hmm. Sexual violence being a very private affair, often tainted with shame. So it's not always out in the public sphere that the internet represents, but it's been very diluted and kind of like stretched to its limits. But its initial intent has yet to, like, the justice seeking of the movement has not mm-hmm. been realized.
Well, I feel like that's where there's some interesting overlap with, like, environmental justice, for example, because, dilution was a word that came to mind for me, but also, like, the idea of corporatization, mm-hmm. of, like, just how quickly, like, as you were saying, the kind of roots of the Me Too movement were stripped away from the discourse. Like, it just reminds me of, and then, you know, turned into like Hollywood films and Hollywood dramas and everything. Yeah. And like, it reminds me a lot of the trajectory of kind of environmental justice slowly turning into, like, you know, Dollarama selling, you know, bags that say reuse me. And like, that's like our most ubiquitous encounter with with environmental justice from day to day. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's also this question of trying not to dilute the personal experience. So to what I was saying about, you know, feelings that might exist artistically in 2017, 2018, and trying to honor them and take them very seriously rather than seeing them just as like an artistic product, that's something that's removed from how you are, from who you are. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To remember the roots and to remember the integrity. Rather than to just treat it as an artistic product that you're trying to sell tickets to. That's actually an interesting, like, journey in a way as an artist, when there's inevitably a distance from when you created your work to take it seriously with the intentions that you set from the beginning. It's interesting. I don't know if it's always possible, but yeah.
Do you want to expand on that a little, in this trajectory for yourself? Well, it's like very visceral themes, like the destruction of the earth and the violation of bodies. It's like very visceral.
I mean, the main connection for me between environmental justice and Me Too in relation to, you know, personal experience in this play is the question of nature, you know, the nature is something that is changing, you know, i.e. climate change, and thinking about nature as a sort of synonym for who you are, who you're meant to be, your gender, your body, you know, what you arrive with on this earth versus what where you go and whatever, so in a way I was kind of trying to look at when nature has the potential not to necessarily be something beautiful, but to also be something that can be very confusing, hard to understand, can be violent, can be destructive, that you're at odds with in a way. So, and I felt like I was writing this play at a time when I was really going through more of a period of dipping my toes into exploring kind of other genders, other sexualities, not just internally, but also externally, and feeling this kind of unstoppable sense of change. And now it's interesting to feel like that's a chapter that for me has some resolution, and I feel I do really strongly believe in like a sense of fluidity, that maybe you go back to things after you have a sense that you've closed a chapter on them. But it's interesting right now I am in a place where I'm not necessarily externally exploring different aspects of the gender of which I've was assigned. So to go back to this text that is really in full swing of those feelings of, oh, maybe I'm not who people see me as, it's very artistically challenging. And I'm part of the battle of, not the battle, but the craft, I guess, of presenting this is really honoring those intentions that were set in creating this piece, and not being dismissive or apologetic of them. Yeah. Just if I'm making myself clear. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, complicated topics, but both as an artist and just as a person, we always risk our being misunderstood when in conversation, when exposing ourselves. And the question of gender modality, or just the having access to the freedom of changing, mm-hmm. God being changed, and having the right to, you know, experiment, try things out, let things go, adopt things, abandon them, you know, that's very important for everyone, and not strictly people who publicly and, you know, identify with transness. And there's kind of this, I don't know, I was having conversations this week actually with a friend who is transmasculine and is always... I'm going on a tangent, but I feel mm-hmm. like it's kind of related.
I'm on the edge of my seat.
With a transmasculine friend who, you know, once in a while, like, you know, once or twice a year, will go like, oh my God, you know, is this kind of a mirage? Is this like a fever dream? Mm-hmm. Even though they're years into this process, they will still doubt themselves, which is something that we all do. No matter how far, you know, quote unquote, along on the journey we are, of kind of being worried about faking it, or about giving into, you know, generalized misogyny, for example, in the case of that person, just like, am I really trans, or am I, you know, have I internalized hating women? You know, that's the question that comes up mm-hmm. again and again and again. And there's been such a kind of I don't know if stigma is the right word, but just a kind of a confusion around the concept of detransitioning, for example, that we see any and all doubt, variation, questioning as a sign of not being genuine, you know? And I personally, as a transsexual, very much disagree with that. And I think it's absolutely possible to simultaneously recognize the vast, you know, differences between the lived experiences of, you know, visibly transsexual people in the public sphere and that of people who are questioning. We can hold complex thoughts simultaneously. We can do that, and we can still have space and freedom to explore our own gender modality without being strictly and firmly and rigidly tied to something, and have to, if we adopt a name, if we adopt a, you know, a terminology, then we can never let it go, or else we'd been faking the whole time. I think that's a very dangerous slippery slope that I've seen, you know, people go down. And yeah, kind of went on a tangent there, but it's just been on my mind a lot recently. That it's just like, let people figure things out in their own time and space and at their own rhythm. Mm-hmm. Change is fine. Like, it's okay.
Totally. Totally. Yeah, no, totally. I mean, also, it's very tricky to start to take on language and then feel guilt about abandoning that language, or expecting people to keep up with you if you take on or give up language, and taking on a guilt yourself in that, if you know what I mean. And even like in the past few years, like some of the language around which we talk about these issues, not just personal questions of gender identity, but all, even going back to like Me Too and stuff, like the language around that changes very constantly. Yeah. And it can be to permit yourself a certain fluidity with that can I think be a very beautiful thing.
Yeah. And not to make a bad pun or whatever, but also very natural.
Yes.
Terminology and strategies also, because yes, if we think of the Me Too movement, like the strategizing is always at stakes, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, with the show, for example, I feel like a very important parallel to me between these movements is that, you know, in our day and age, they're both consumed through screens, you know, on, you know, reading call outs on Facebook or Instagram or whatever, and also seeing images of environmental destruction on social media or, you know, on the news, whatever. And this kind of question for me emerged of, you know, how do you start to identify your nature when the only examples of nature that you see are kind of horrible images of violence, or at, in the time of Me Too, the gender binary was really existing as a very charged binary, you know, and where is the room to explore within that when the media was at that time setting up a very clear binary that was in a way helpful of, like, you know, predator, etc. So that's a very tricky time to kind of question your own gender. I feel like this piece has really emerged also from kind of the like surcharge of information, receiving a lot at once, consuming different conflicting informations from the same media, you know, different accounts of the same stories, and kind of navigating through a cacophony of stuff that can sometimes be extremely inspiring and truthful, also can be very daunting and compelling and scary. And yeah, so it's interesting. In this piece that I'm at, that I was writing, it's kind of like, well, what if you surcharge the audience with conflicting information at once, with a sense of cacophony? You know, what emerges?
Mm-hmm. And from cacophony, people can make the meaning that they want to make. You're right to name that, you know, that binary was very much ever-present at that period, and that it was useful in some ways. But it also, ironically, has kind of affected the way in which we can talk about the violence that is both experienced by trans people and inflicted by trans people.
Mama, can I, huh? Mama, can I, huh? Can I, mama, won't you please let me? Mama, can I, huh? That's the sweetest little dress, Sally. Where'd you get the pattern? Made me one just like it out of yellow dotted Swiss. Yes, I guess we got the earliest garden in the county. Been eating strawberries all week, snapping green beans.
Too bad about your boy.
Mama, make Willie quit pulling at my hair. Mama, ouch, ouch, mama, just make Willie quit it.
Tommy, if you don't put down that stick, I'm gonna wear you out with it, boy. Be quick.
Come quick, Sammy Jean stuck a finger in a Coke bottle. Can't get it out, cause it's stuck, stuck, stuck.
Now, I told you my mama didn't raise no fool. I can do anything if I got the right tool.
Mama, can I, huh? Mama, can I, huh? Huh? Can I, mama, won't you please let me? Mama, can I, huh?
The crop's been failing, Lord, it sure is dry. You think that we'll get a sprinkle by and by?
Gonna tear you up, girl, gonna get a switch. Better tell your cousin that you're sorry that you hit her.
If I told you once, it's been a thousand times. We'd ask to your uncle for nickels and dimes.
Mama, make Willie quit it, pulling that man. Mama, ow, ow, mama, just make Willie quit it.
I told you my mama didn't leave no rules. I can do anything if I got the right to.
Did it again, put a finger in a Coke bottle. Can't get it out, cause it's stuck, stuck, stuck.
All in a head cool, that's all you have. You can fix it right up with a job excel.
It's the first time ever that the family's been together. It's so nice that we all get along so well.
He's got the money, you think he'd try to do something for his mama before she died.
Now I don't mean to criticize your cooking, no I don't, but I think that you could add a little bit of pepper.
I told you my mama didn't raise no food. I could do anything if I got the right to.
Mama, make Willie quit.
Why, yes, I guess. And don't you look nice in your Sunday dress?
Doesn't Sally look tacky in a silly little dress? You can see that she just doesn't know no better.
Rosalie go off to Memphis by herself.
Mama, can I, huh? Mama, can I, huh, huh? Mama, won't you please let me? Mama, mama, can I, huh?
You've just heard Reunion by Bobby Gentry, the wonderful Bobby Gentry. You're still listening to Audio Smut on CKUT 90.3 FM. And I am still Mycelium talking with Michael Martini about his upcoming show, Landscape Grinder. Michael, do you want to tell us why you chose this song?
Yes, I would love to. I just think, well, we were talking about surcharge and cacophony, and I just think that song is a beautiful example of like cacophony of different information coming at you at once, different layers of sound. You could listen to it several times and still not fully catch what the people are talking about in the background, but I don't think it's necessarily that important. It's more like, to me, it seems like it's more about creating texture and color than kind of telling a very, well, kind of tells the story from different directions through like non sequiturs, through like little pieces of information all happening at once that are not necessarily in response to one another. And I just find that extremely inspiring, you know, especially for theater. I feel I'm really not super interested in plays that are kind of Netflix-esque, where there's scenes of like dialogue that are centered around conflict, and then there's a set change and it's another scene about a conflict with dialogue, and then it all comes together. And I think that there's like, I am willing to fight the battle of like cacophony in theater and like non sequiturs and dialogue that is more like, you know, just opening your ears to what multiple people are saying at once in a room, you know, zoning out at the house party kind of feeling. Mm. And that's not to say that that's present everywhere in the play that I'm presenting shortly, but it certainly is in at least one or two scenes. And let's die on the hill of cacophony, I say.
Nice. Yeah, it's nice to hear you talk about your writing process and methods, because this is kind of like your, as you said before, your quote-unquote specialty, or like the what you were trained in as a theater artist. Do you want to tell us a bit more about writing and dramaturgy?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would love to talk about that. I mean, I switched into the playwriting program mostly because I could not stand the fact that this like conservatory type training and performance has you waking up at like 8 a.m. to like scream in a room full of your peers and roll around on the floor and talk about your traumas until they make you cry during your Ibsen monologue. You know, I think that's absolutely, it can be kind of, I'm not saying to my extent it was abusive, but I understand how it could be for certain people.
It is abusive.
Yeah, especially with, you know, also these power dynamics of like older men directing like 18-year-old girls and et cetera. Anyway, all that to say is my version is that I was like, okay, I need to just start writing stuff that I actually want to do rather than being handed out scripts that I don't want to work on at all. And I also don't want to get up at 8 a.m. to do that. So I found myself in this unusual playwriting degree that only has like 2 students a year. So you have a lot of freedom to do other stuff. And I enjoyed that very much. And I think around the I really remember reading a play at a certain point by Elfriede Jelinek. I read it on a plane. I like bought it before flying somewhere. I was on exchange. And that play really changed, or that playwright rather, really changed my ideas about writing. That it, as we were saying, it didn't have to just be snappy dialogue. Although, you know, we all have a taste for snappy dialogue here and there, but you could also really just explore other forms of text on stage, paragraphs and paragraphs and paragraphs, if you found a way to make it work. And that has definitely stuck with me in writing and exploring dialogue not as a default, but exploring dialogue as kind of a mode that can exist within other ways of using text on stage. You know, to me also writing a note in my notebook that, okay, I walk on stage and then I stare at the audience and then I sit down and I think for a few seconds. To me, that's also text. Even if we're not saying it out loud, that's a way of playwriting. And it can be very beautiful stage directions that I give myself. And the question is, how do I share that text with the audience? And I think that sometimes dialogue can be really useful and really interesting. But to me, I can't think about dialogue without thinking of like capital D dialogue, which, you know, brings me back to, you know, talking about Me Too and movements of the like, and these moments where people would say, you know, like, in order to figure this out, we really just need to have a dialogue. Or like these two people, they just have to have a mediated dialogue between them and they'll figure it out. To me, that word was so present in like 2017 or so. Dialogue is the answer, you know, like, or even when you think about like world issues, they say, oh, well, these two countries are going to have, they need to have a dialogue, whatever. They need to sit down and talk. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I can't think about dialogue as a mode in theater without thinking of like what dialogue means and the way that we use it day to day. And to me, you know, especially in Landscape Grinder, the show that's coming up, I think there's kind of a tongue-in-cheek way that you can explore that of like dialogue being precious and being the answer and having to be extremely well organized and emerging from chaos and not necessarily being facilitated by the right people. You're laughing because I guess because you saw a little rehearsal or something. But yeah, that's definitely one of my favorite moments in the play is when after, you know, so much non-text and so much nonsense and so much monologue, there's finally we agree that now is the time to have some dialogue in the play. Mm. And well, you'll have to come see how that pans out.
Yes, you sure have. But I find what you're saying so interesting. And to come back to Cacophony, there's something so absurd with the amount and juxtaposition of discourse, like the overbearing, you know, presence of people talking. Like, mm-hmm. and I say that with a lot of irony because I am literally a radio host, you know, I'm literally just another person adding on to, I do, you know, talk radio.
Yes.
I do spoken word radio and, this is something that I worry about in my own art practice, which often includes mics and talking and discourse and statements. And I often wonder like, who are we to, you know, add on to the chatter and add on to the noise? And so I find it so absurd when the suggestion of, oh, we just need more dialogue. We just need more conversation. Just need more talking. And then, you know, world peace, you know, yeah. It's something so kind of
it's
inefficient
like, yeah.
About this.
It's one thing to like talk. That's great. It's another thing to like talk about talking. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It's like, it's great to be on the radio with you. It'd be really different if every time I saw you for a year, you were like, you know, we should really talk on the radio. And then we never did. Like that, you know? And it's like thinking about statements, you know, you know, publishing statuses or whatever. Like, to me, also, those are monologues, right? Mm. Like, at a certain point, mm. I mean, you know, yes. not like, when it's so short that Facebook gives you a little background, but when it's long enough, you know, eventually, at a certain point, you're monologuing, right? And then the comment section is a bit like the Greek chorus or the dialogue that accompanies your monologue. And, well, I think that's funny, and it's definitely been a part of the writing process of this show is, you know, what is a monologue? How much space does it take up? And what about dialogue? Anyway, it's just funny. Like, to me, it's connecting those dots, like connecting lowercase dialogue to like capital letters, let's have a dialogue, is a very interesting theatrical exercise, and it's fun, yeah. Mm-hmm. And when are we in dialogue with screens, you know, all of that, it's interesting.
Yeah, screens are present both as a theme, of course we can hear it in the title itself, you know, Grinder, and the presence,
yes.
It's implied, but also as a scenography, as a stage design, the screen is important.
A lot of information in the show is communicated in screens, through screens, just as we consume media about the environment, whatever the themes of the show. And also, this interesting question came up. One of the first times that we did a reading of the show, someone said, yeah, to me, the show is all about projection. And that really stayed with me following the, as I continued to work on the show after that first reading. I think that person was kind of on the money, and it was really exciting to work with creatively. And that, no, the show is not just about projections in the sense that there's a projector projecting text on stage, but also projecting feelings onto the audience, projecting yourself onto different characters, projections of guilt and shame. Like, that's all, that's interesting to me also, to connect with the projector as an object. And then also this inevitable question that we explore in the show that I think is has been fun to explore, which is, we put so much trust in the screen that it can memorize, that it can be programmed, that it's reliable, that that it works on its own, etc. And then, well, those situations where the projector dies or where the projector malfunctions are so shocking and disappointing. And, well, there, I think there must be a connection there with the environment also, and assuming that it works on its own, and it, and that it doesn't overheat. You know? So it's been fun to explore that too in the show. You know.
Well, we have a few minutes ahead of us before the show inevitably closes. Is there maybe a theme or a method that you would like to discuss before we go on and listen to our very last song?
Well, what comes to mind, I don't know, it could be interesting to talk about monologue in the show, and like also the use of radio. I mean, we're on the radio now, but the, also the radio is very present in the show, is kind of this device of a feeling of fluidity. What am I tuning into now? When do I change the channel?
And the white noise of the radio as well.
The white noise, static. And also the radio, of course, as something we consume information from. And then, yeah, monologue also as a kind of through line in the show, also of information, but also information that we assume to be emotional, kind of like a wall of feeling or emotion, and the feeling of listening to someone on the radio talk and talk and talk. There's a lot of monologue in the show. They're very long monologues, but they are the they're the only moments in the show where people are characters, and it kind of creates a feeling of cacophony of like Facebook statuses or something like that. Not, but they're mostly, they aren't performed incredibly theatrically. They're very simple. They're full of information. And I think with a monologue, it's interesting to start with the first person, but to kind of arrive somewhere very ecstatic by the end of it, or very to kind of lose the first person along the way, where eventually you're going from something quite small and personal to something quite all-encompassing. And ultimately, the show kind of positions climate change as like a monologue by nature, I feel. Like, you know, something that it's prepared for a while and that we're kind of witnessing as an audience and being like, you know, maybe giving some notes on here and there. But like, it feels like we're getting maybe toward the end of the monologue, I don't know, or maybe it's just beginning. It's like nature's long Facebook status. So that's just beginning, maybe. But anyway, that's kind of something I'm interested in. And, yeah.
I find that's an interesting approach to kind of the like eschatological. I never know how to pronounce that in English.
Eschatological.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. La perspective eschatologique de la fin du monde, entre guillemets, tu sais, of the imminent apocalypse, you know, which itself is directly inherited, you know, from our long, how can I say it? The ever presence of Christianity at the end of the day has really like impacted the way we understand time, and also just white supremacy is definitely understood and described scientifically. Time as something that's straightforward. There's kind of an arc that has a beginning and an end.
Yes.
And maybe another beginning, but only after the end, you know, only after death, either personal or collective. I think that's an interesting way to frame that end of time as like the end of a play or the end of a monologue or like the end of a drawn out breath.
Yes, and there's so much to do before it ends, isn't there?
Yeah.
Or this question of, you know, sometimes the show seems to be over and you is it over? Is it, or the, you know, that feeling in a movie when you're sure it's the final scene and then another scene starts.
Yes.
You know, sometimes that's how nature feels too. I don't know. For example, 2012, you know, everyone was like, oh, everything's going to explode and, you know, the sea's going to rise and this and this and this. And then it's like, oh, well, I guess that wasn't the last scene of the movie.
Yeah.
You know? I guess that wasn't the last monologue in the play.
And even like climate denial as kind of this, you know, fingers crossed that it was all a dream, you know?
Yeah, I still have my fingers crossed.
That the end is not nigh.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, fabulous. We have maybe 2 minutes ahead of us. Do you have closing thoughts, closing comments, closing questions, closing invitations?
Yeah, I mean, it would be, I guess, you know, the right time to give people, if they're curious about seeing the show, some of the information. So,
yes.
Yeah, the show is called Landscape Grinder, which comes from, you know, about 1,000 screenshots I've collected of people using landscapes as their profile pictures on Grindr. You know, again, nature, sexuality, the environment, you know. The show is called Landscape Grinder. It's playing, opening April 11th. It plays 4 times. And it's at Théâtre La Chapelle, Scène Contemporaine, which is in the Plateau. And the opening is only $15. I think the other ones, tickets are like 20 to 30 or so. And it's going to be interesting. We have about 4 days to dot all the T's and cross all the I's, or rather cross all the T's and dot all the I's, and make our last few, copy, paste, cuts, deletes. And I'm very excited to share this work that's been in the works for too long.
Yeah.
I'm ready to, you know, pass its due date.
Yeah, 5 years later, it's so nice that it's coming together.
Yeah, things move slowly around here, I would say.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, the water has broken. It's time to share. So
it's time to push that baby out. Well, thank you so much for coming into the studio today, Michael. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, and now I suggested for the last song what I would consider a beautiful monologue by Kate Bush.
Yes. We've heard 3 very strong, beautiful, iconic singer-songwriters today.
Yes,
the show.
Exactly.
Thank you for your suggestions. This was Audio Smut on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's almost 7 now. I guess it's about time you start making dinner. My name is Mycelium, and I was talking with the lovely Michael Martini. And this is Rocket's Tale by Kate Bush. Just have a great night.
Qui est assez enclavé. Donc de cette façon-là, donc avec donc ces vélos que les gens vont pouvoir utiliser, les vélos vont être stationnés à différents.
Radio rebroadcast from the 3rd of March 2022.
Africa unite, Fatsalelile.
ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Amandla this week at CQUT 90.3. Amandla Radio is brought to you by Doug Miller and Gwen Schulman. We are offering you news, analysis, and insights about Africa that you won't get elsewhere. This week, of course, the focus is on NATO and Russia and the Ukraine. And that's totally normal, since that's all we can hear about anywhere in the news. And, of course, it's an outrageous, egregious situation. But we at Amandla stand solidly behind our comrades at Échec à la Guerre. Just to remind you, Échec à la Guerre was formed as a result of coalition building during the 2003 protests in the dead of winter, when the United States was attempting to push its NATO allies to join it in its illegal and extremely bad occupation of